Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames. Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. How do you build trust in a distrustful world? That's a question the founder of Wikipedia seeks to answer in a new book. The Global Online Encyclopedia celebrates 25 years next month and fends off GOP-led accusations of liberal bias. Today, Wikipedia's founder Jimmy Wales joins us to talk about his book, The Seven Rules of Trust, 25 years of Wikipedia, and why Wikipedia has incurred the wrath of Republicans. Welcome back to All Sides, Jimmy.
Thanks for having me on. Good to be here.
I asked a question at the very beginning. I just said, I know that the whole book, you wrote a whole book about trust, but how do you build trust in a distrustful world, especially right now?
So the whole point of the Seven Rules of Trust is to draw on my experience and also look at some academic research about what people and organizations need to do to build trust. And a lot of it's going to be pretty obvious if you think about it. Be transparent, be personal, have a good purpose. That's actually a really important one. That's been really important for Wikipedia because people can predict what we're going to do. They know we're going to be writing an encyclopedia. And so that makes it much easier for us to make decisions.
Well, Wikipedia is just shy of its 25th anniversary, and it wasn't always considered trustworthy at the very beginning because every day people could edit the content. How did you work to change that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of it was when we got started, we were just being bold and having some fun. So we just started writing, and obviously, even though we had the same vision that we had today as we had back then, a free, neutral, high-quality encyclopedia, we were just getting started. So you might be the first person to type Paris is a city in France and like, ta-da, look at my amazing encyclopedia article. So obviously people wouldn't trust that. They would go, okay, like I went to this encyclopedia, I had one sentence, so what? But the quality grew over time. And, you know, that growth in the quality and our, you know, sticking to that core purpose year in, year out, always trying to make things better. Slowly but surely, you know, won people over and got people's attention.
It's hard to talk about trust and not refer to what's happening in our country politically right now. America and the world have grown more polarized, they're more divided, more distrustful. Your new book argues that trust is the answer to these problems. But how can something as simple as trust solve a complicated issue like that?
Well, trust is simple and it's also not simple. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's that. But certainly trust and the failure of trust and the failure to be trustworthy really does impact and drive a lot of the different issues that we have. I would lay the blame for the recent very, very long government shutdown in the U.S. to neither side being able to trust each other. They weren't able to sort of put down the sticks and say, let's find a compromise. Let's have a little give and take. Let's figure out what we can do that we can agree on. And instead, it was just like complete, you know, warfare, and nobody was willing to budge an inch. And it took far too long, and it really interfered with the normal process of governing. That's just one example. You know, there are a lot of other things. You know, we do know that when we see an enormous decline in trust in politics, trust in journalism, people do become vulnerable to populist people who will say, you know, nonsense to them, but very appealing nonsense. And so we need to get back to facts. We need to get back to trust. We need to really insist that our politicians be trustworthy.
Wikipedia has found itself in the crosshairs of Republican leaders. The Trump administration has threatened its nonprofit status. The GOP-led House Oversight Committee launched an investigation into bias on Wikipedia. What do you think motivates these feelings of unfairness and bias from the right when it comes to all this attention on Wikipedia?
Well, I mean, I think there's a few things. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that this is an administration that is not particularly comfortable with facts. And I know that's sounds like a biased thing to say, but I also think it's true. And I think it's something that we have to grapple with, no matter what your politics are. I think that's a problem. But second, I mean, I always say, look, if somebody criticizes Wikipedia, our response shouldn't be to engage in a PR exercise and to deny it and everything, but to go, okay, let's take it seriously. Like, what can we improve? Like, what in Wikipedia would they like to see changed and made better? And in some cases, you know, you'll get the answer and you'll say, yeah, no, actually, we're not going to treat conspiracy theories as being the same as, you know, high quality sourced information. In other cases, we can say, okay, actually, yeah, actually, we probably should grapple with this issue a bit better. And also, we need to be open and welcoming because Wikipedia is for everyone, and everyone means literally everyone.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Jimmy Wales, Wikipedia founder and author of the new book, Seven Rules of Trust. So, with Wikipedia using community volunteers, how do you strike that balance of tone and content to guard against political bias creeping in? Because sometimes the tone of a sentence can indicate a little bias.
I mean, definitely. And it's a constant work. It's a constant discussion and debate within the community. And, you know, what's really important is that we have a community that's very passionately committed to the ideals of Wikipedia, more so than committed to whatever political agenda they have. So, the way I talk about this is community health. Like, are we doing our work in the way that matches our values? And that's what we always have to work on. And so, you know, it really is about things like, oh, are we treating newcomers well? If somebody comes in with a complaint, are we listening? Are we just dismissing them? Things like, oh, in the writing, like, oh, how did we write these sentences? And, you know, like you point out, like a sentence can have a lot of nuance and things like that. And so you want to say, okay, like let's review some of these things and let's say, is there a way to rewrite it that's a little bit more inclusive, more fair, more, you know, accepting of the nuance of the world?
There are certain news outlets that Wikipedia does not source information from. Fox News and Newsmax are two of those. What is the reason that you don't cite sources that are Fox News and Newsmax?
We do cite those as sources. They are not banned as sources. You know, I think what we do look out for is if there are news sources that are low quality. So it doesn't really matter about the political leaning, it's about the quality. I would say, you know, there are some left-wing sources that we won't cite for sure. And so why? It all comes down to, you know, a track record for correcting errors, a track record for accuracy, a track record for not inflaming stories in a sort of silly, ridiculous way. And, you know, various outlets are better or worse at that. And obviously then the community will take that seriously. I mean, I have seen a claim that, you know, the Wikipedia doesn't cite any right-wing sources. And I'm like, well, okay, if you think that Wall Street Journal's a left-wing communist rag, then maybe that's right. But actually, it's not about left and right, it's about quality.
How do you separate if you're citing a source that's MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, any of those? How do you determine whether the source is commentary piece versus like a more news piece? Do you have a way to determine that?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that all the news media needs to be very careful about in their own work is making a clear distinction between the opinion of the journalist and fact-based reporting. And obviously, that's a blurry line sometimes. It's quite kind of hard to say. I think what we try to do is you look at a piece and you can tell from the language sometimes that it's more opinion than fact. And then you look for the opposite. You look for, okay, who else has written about this? One of the examples I love to give, I love electric cars. I live in London, and there are two good quality newspapers here, The Telegraph and The Guardian. The Telegraph is, there are more papers than that. They're just my example papers. Telegraph is right leaning, Guardian's left leaning. Telegraph hates electric cars, Guardian loves electric cars. So it reduces my trust in both papers. But if I'm going to, you know, write something in Wikipedia about, oh, a new study about electric cars came out, I'm going to want to look at both. I'm going to say, okay, let's actually see, let's tease out, and actually, ideally, I'll go to the original research report and sort of triangulate. That's the job of Wikipedians, and you know, that's what we spend our life sort of passionately debating about and working on.
Elon Musk has called Wikipedia Wokepedia, and he launched his own alternative site called Grokopedia, which uses AI-generated tools. So first, what is your response to Elon Musk creating Grokopedia?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I look at large language models. I use them a lot. I test them. I play with them. I'm a geek and I love this kind of stuff. It's an amazing technology, but it's definitely not good enough to write encyclopedia articles. The hallucination problem is still very bad, and that is more true the more obscure the topic. If you ask about something very, very famous, so ask about Taylor Swift, it's probably pretty decent. But if you ask about more, you know, a mayor of Poland, a mayor of Warsaw in 1880, boy, it's just going to make stuff up out of thin air. It's completely not usable. And the problem with the AI is that it makes stuff up that's plausible. And so you really can't trust it. You really do need to go back to original sources. You need to really chew on ideas. You need to have human beings having an enormous discussion to try and get to the bottom of things. So I'm not that impressed, you know, but the technology will improve. And so, you know, ask me again in a few years and we'll see how it's come along.
Do you think that anything will come of it, Elon Musk having a competitor to what you do?
I have no idea. I don't actually. You know, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about us, we're a charity, we're a nonprofit organization. And I'm a volunteer. I don't have a salary. I just do this because I love it. And, you know, it's, for us, we have a hobby. Our hobby is writing an encyclopedia. And it turns out, wow, the world is like, they love our hobby. Like they like reading what we've done, but that's not why we did it. And so we'll carry on regardless. So if his, you know, Grokopedia gets popular, yeah, good for him. That's fine. It's not good for him, though, if it's full of propaganda and misleading information. And I think that's what we've got to be concerned about.
Back to your book, one theme that I found throughout your book of the 7 Rules of Trust was empathy. What does empathy mean for you in your personal life as well as your professional life?
Yeah, I mean, it really is, you know, if you want to build trust with people, one of the things you need to do is understand where they're coming from. Understand what do they need from you. Understand what is their situation. So let's say in a Wikipedia context, okay, I meet you and we're having a debate about some topic. And it would be a real mistake for me to think, wow, you're just a horrible human being. That's why you believe these things. It's probably not true. Like empirically, that's just generally not true. People are actually very nice. And instead to say, okay, like, why are you saying this? This seems surprising to me. What is the evidence you're going to put forward? What do I need to learn about so I can understand where you're coming from? It doesn't mean I'm going to agree in the end, but it does mean that we can work together in a more effective way. I can get more of what I want. You can get more of what you want. We can write something that we can both point to with pride and say, yeah, this explains the debate. And that's what we should be doing here at Wikipedia. So, I mean, for me, empathy is a real, you know, when you've lost empathy, you run roughshod over people and they definitely don't end up trusting you.
We're running short on time, but I wanted to know, you know, your book has 7 rules. Is there one of the 7 rules that you think is most important for people to know about, or one that represents your personal philosophy the best?
I mean, I think the one that means the most for me, particularly in the context of Wikipedia, is to have a good purpose. And Wikipedia has a very, very simple purpose, a free, high quality, neutral encyclopedia in all the languages of the world. That's always been our purpose. It's our only real purpose. And as long as we stay focused on that, then we can solve all the problems. And that really helps a lot to build trust within our community. We all know what we're here for, but also trust with everyone else in the world.
I can remember when I was in high school and college not being allowed to cite in Wikipedia for, you know, if I was writing a paper. But now my kids are allowed to cite Wikipedia.
Oh,
so what do you think of that? What do you think of that, you know, that over time, that I guess that signifies trust in Wikipedia. The teachers trust it now.
It does. Although, I mean, I'm always a little unsure about this because what I've always said about that is when I was in high school, we weren't allowed to cite Britannica as a source because you should go deeper. Now, maybe when you're 13 years old, yeah, you know, write a footnote. Hey, good progress, right? You know, you actually gave credit for what you read and you wrote a footnote. Very good. But at any older age, the role of the encyclopedia and the research process is to get you oriented. It should be high quality, but that doesn't necessarily mean you should cite it. You should use it as a starting point to dig deeper.
All right. Well, my kids are in middle school, so maybe when they're in high
school.
Oh,
yeah, middle school, great. Yeah. That's fantastic.
All right.
Middle school.
Yeah. So maybe when they're in high school, they won't be allowed to cite in Wikipedia. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And hopefully they'll be told, go to Wikipedia. It's a great place to start. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to start doing research. But just regurgitating Wikipedia entry, nobody needs that, you know, that anybody can go read Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. Now, let's start thinking about how do we improve it? How do we go deeper? Like, what's not in Wikipedia? That's the process of education and learning.
And just finally, literacy rates have decreased across the board in the U.S., especially among young children. And as a child, you spent a lot of time reading encyclopedias. I mean, that's kind of how you ended up here. But how important do you feel it is for young people to be inquisitive, read in general, but maybe like just try to learn some things from Wikipedia?
I mean, I think it's massively important. And young people do love Wikipedia. You know, I look at some of these numbers with a bit of dismay, but I also know literacy rates, they go up, they go down. Like, this isn't a great time, but I think we'll be okay. I also remind people when it's quite easy for adults to think, these kids, they're just doing their TikTok videos and this and that. But you know what they're also doing? They're also listening to podcasts at a much higher rate than adults are. They're also binging very complicated long-form culture and entertainment, TV shows. And so I'm quite optimistic about the young people. I just think they definitely should read a book now and then.
All right. We've been talking with Jimmy Wales, Wikipedia founder and author of 7 Rules of Trust. Thank you so much for your time today, Jimmy.
Lovely. Thanks for having me on.
And coming up, we are going to talk about why people hold on to their phones for so long now. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. With Apple's new iPhone 17, Americans are going to have to decide between keeping their old phone or upgrading and indulging in its new features. But many Americans are choosing to hold on to their phones for longer, with most giving up their phones right under the 3-year mark. So why are people holding onto their tech for longer, and what does it mean for big tech companies and the tech industry? Joining us now is Kelly Ha, a staff writer for ClearLink. Welcome to Tech Tuesday, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you recently released a report that showed that the average American was holding onto their phone for longer. Can you tell us, how long does that mean? What do you mean holding onto it longer?
Yes. So yeah, we recently published our smartphone lifespan report through reviews.org. And we found that Americans want to upgrade their phone at a faster rate, but they're actually finding that they're keeping their phone for about 2 years and 5 months. And this is something we found quite interesting, considering that every year there's a new release from Apple. The iPhone 17 was just released recently. And this kind of gives off the impression that people are upgrading their phone, leveling up every year in order to keep up with social media trends, AI capabilities. But in reality, people are keeping their phones for just about as long as a battery life is lasting. Since a smartphone battery lasts for about 2 to 3 years, that's about the same time as how long people are keeping their phones for.
So it's more so that people are annoyed at having to charge their phone all the time, and that's why they get a new one, not that they want the new technology.
Yeah, I guess something that we found was that about 22% of the survey participants, they found that they wanted faster performance. So their phones were also lagging, weren't really performing to the standard that they needed it to. And with smartphones being, so important to us in our everyday lives, there's things that we need, not just for entertainment and for, going on social media. They're just important facets. They're, just like your right-hand man when it comes to everything, healthcare, work, travel, and yeah. And we also found that 18% of the participants said battery issues. So it's kind of a dual thing between wanting the phone to just do what it's supposed to be doing and then also lasting longer, so that you can have it all day.
Was there anything else besides the battery life and wanting it to perform better? Did people indicate any other reasons why they want to upgrade a phone?
Yeah, so a lower percentage, so about 13%, wanted new features. Then we also have below that those who want those who have a broken or lost phone, compatibility with 5G networks, perhaps also wanting a better camera. But these were under 13% of the survey.
Do you think that the tech companies, I mean, they come out with a new phone every year. Do they want people to get a new phone every year? Is that their goal?
Yeah, I think that is the goal, and also to kind of show that they have these different capabilities that are newer and different, and supposedly life-changing. But I think people can kind of see through that and realize what are the main things that I actually need out of my phone, and it's just that it functions. A lot of people don't really need these different AI capabilities or different nifty little things that these companies are adding on. Yeah, genuinely, people are just wanting something that works.
Have the numbers changed over time, though? Did Americans used to give up their phones less than 2 years and 5 months, years ago?
We're not quite sure whether it's changed over time, but more so that people have the intention to upgrade sooner. They have a desire to upgrade sooner, but they decide not to, due to cost and also the being able to just make do with what they currently have. And I think that's kind of the key point, is that even if people would like to upgrade their phones faster, these kind of barriers prevent them from doing so.
Yeah, that was my next question. How much of a price is a barrier? Because if you get a new phone every year, I mean, you're not, if even if you're on a payment plan, you're not paying off the old one.
Yes, very true.
Okay, and so then, do you also think that a part of it is that phones are lasting longer? Like maybe when smartphones first came out, 15, 20 years ago, they just didn't, they weren't as durable, maybe cases weren't as good, and also they just didn't last as long.
Yeah, that could be the case. One of the things that we saw that was that the most common phone that people had was the actual iPhone 13. So this is an older model. Previous models perhaps didn't have the best battery life, but people are finding that this phone lasts and kind of stands the test of time. I think people are satisfied with the different features that it has, and beyond this, like the different upgrades, the 14, 15, 16, 17, these are not really, they don't have significantly astounding features that make people want to upgrade. The 13 is doing the job.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Americans keeping their tech longer with Kelly Haas, staff writer for ClearLink. How does the United States compare to other countries? Do we replace technology faster or slower than most other countries?
I think there is a trend in the US where there are a lot of different payment plans, like you said earlier, and opportunities to upgrade faster. Like we have different programs for various carriers that say, if you sign up now, you can upgrade every year. And these are very common marketing tactics. And I think people are enticed by this opportunities that they can upgrade as soon as the next one is out. But I think more recently, people are kind of seeing through that and realizing that this isn't maybe the best investment, and it's expensive to do this.
What about other technologies? Are people holding on to laptops or tablets longer too?
I think this is the case for other technologies where just the cost of living it's expensive, and so people are trying to find ways to keep any technology that they own for longer. And then what we've kind of found is like with a smartphone, it's almost like an appliance. It's like a household appliance with laptops, TVs, just these things you need in your everyday life. And so people kind of have to think of it like they're investing in something for the next few years. But yeah, I think there's a similar kind of sentiment there with laptops with battery life and faster performance. Those are the things that people want.
Are all consumer electronics sticking around longer? Do you feel like, is it just phones are more durable, or people, I was just wondering if have laptops gotten better with their battery life and how long they can function?
I wouldn't necessarily say that they're getting better. It's more that people don't have a lot of choice and they have to keep what they have. Even if something is not lasting very long or isn't really performing to the standard that they would like and that's convenient for them, they're kind of faced with this decision where they need to keep something that doesn't really carry out its function as good as it used to, because it's so expensive.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Americans keeping their tech longer with Kelly Ha, staff writer at ClearLink. What effect does Americans keeping their tech longer have on the broader economy? I mean, for the economy's sake, do we need people buying more tech all the time?
It depends on what perspective you're looking at things. And I think, from a corporate perspective, we want people to buy and upgrade sooner. There was a report by CNBC that kind of alluded to that. And yes, there are things that can impact the economy. Like, I think the more people buy phones, these companies are doing better. But I just think this isn't very realistic for the everyday American. I don't think we can really blame people not upgrading in terms of how that impacts the economy. I think there are other things like the prices are going up. Perhaps companies need to create more affordable options. Like something that we found recently with the iPhone 17 release is that the base model iPhone 17 had most of the features that you would expect out of a more expensive phone. And so I think there is some kind of leeway that companies are realizing that they need to make adjustments to suit the average American. But we'll see. I think the iPhone 17 was very successful and Apple continues to grow. And so people are buying. But I think the average American, according to our survey, takes a couple years to do so.
We've been talking a lot about Apple and the iPhone 17, but what about Android? Do people hang on to their Android phones the longer too? Do they upgrade at the same rate, or is Apple different than Android?
Yeah, so in our survey, we collected responses from both Apple and Android users. And the average that we found was across both types of devices. We actually found that more people were using iPhones, but the similar kind of sentiment applies. There was this one woman who, in the CNBC report, who said that she'd had a Samsung Galaxy A71 that was 6 years old. And so she found that she could keep this phone for this long, and the battery life, despite it being quite old, she was still able to use it. So I think people are making do with what they have, and stretching it beyond its, supposed lifespan.
Well, do you think part of it is just the hassle, like learning a new phone, ch making the change, moving all your stuff over? People just don't want to deal with that hassle.
I think for sure, between my phone, my last phone, and my current phone, I actually switched from Android to Apple. And this was such a hassle, like learning the different features. And, I was curious about those AI capabilities, but frankly, I haven't really used them. And so I think there is this kind of comfort when it comes to an older smartphone. You've already learned it and you know exactly how it works and how it functions for you. And so I think people, they're not enticed by these newer features as long as their current phone does the things that they want to do.
Are there any parallels with the upgrading your smartphone, the schedule we have where there's a new one every year, compared to, like, back in the day, having an in-home personal computer? My parents kept their computer for like ever. It wasn't it was, there was never a thought of like switching your computer every year. So, is this just something that the smartphone companies have come up with where they were like, oh, we figured out how to do one little thing better. Let's make a whole new phone.
I think that's part of it. I think there's a race to come out with, the f features that are different and unique and kind of groundbreaking. But also, I think our smartphones hold a different place in our lives than an older, like a home family computer that everyone shares. Like now, we don't have a lot of people don't have home phones. A lot of services that we use don't use paper trails. And so our smartphones are things that we use all day, every day. And so we're not just, logging on to our computer for an hour or two. We're logging on for 5 to 6 hours a day, perhaps sometimes even the whole day. And so this device is something we just use far more frequently than something we back in the day, those home computers.
I've seen some experts say that holding onto your phone for a longer amount of time can impact the nation's broadband service and speeds. Is that true?
I wouldn't say that's true. The broadband speeds that you personally experience kind of depend on what carrier that you have. And also, if your device is older, you might not be able to connect to a 5G service. But that's more on a personal level. It's not that your phone impacts someone else. And yeah, it really just depends on your carrier and what plan that you're on and whether you are on a plan that supports faster speeds.
Have you heard of any tech companies trying to break this cycle where there's a new phone every year, or the frequency of upgrades or updates or that kind of thing? Are there any tech companies that say it's okay to not buy a new one?
Not that I know of. I think it's common to want to release something that is different from your competitors. I do think recently the Samsung Galaxy release is kind of up in the air, and I think that isn't really anything to do with wanting consumers to, think twice about their decisions, but more so because kind of not quite understanding what people want in the market. And so, yeah, I don't think companies are really that altruistic in thinking that people can keep their phones for longer. But I do think they realize that this is happening. So I think they want to make sure that people are satisfied with their current experience so that they upgrade to the same phone in the same line. So I think there is that part of it as well with cell phone carriers. When they sign people up to different plans that include upgrades every year, there are other options as well where you can upgrade not every year, but still kind of like have that option available at a discount. So I think, they're adjusting, realizing that people might upgrade at different times.
Did your research include any phones that are provided through someone's employer, and if that impacts the numbers, or is it just people's personal phones?
It's mostly people's personal phones, but we did include, we did ask people how they got their phones. What we found was that 47% paid upfront in full. And then below that was 35% they financed it through their carrier, like T-Mobile or Verizon. And then further down, we've got people who've gotten their phones through hand-me-downs or as a gift, secondhand, refurbished, or perhaps they got something a little bit later than the release time. So there are various ways that people got their phone beyond just paying upfront.
And just finally, we have about a minute left, but do you think that there's any going to be consumer backlash? Like they don't want the tech companies to dictate, you know, make them spend more, make them get a new phone?
For sure. I think consumers, are realizing that they have the buying power. So, I think people are not super satisfied with a battery life, a battery not lasting multiple years. And so that's one of the major things that people are wanting, in a new phone is something that lasts and, yeah, is functioning.
I want to thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Kelly Ha, a staff writer at ClearLink. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about some tech gadgets that you can give as gifts. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Gift buying season is in full swing. Parents, friends, and family are looking for unique ideas. And this week, our resident tech expert, Russell Hawley, is back with his annual gift guide. And we're going to start off with some tech ideas for the tech enthusiast in your life. Russell Hawley is the Director of Commerce Content for CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So starting off our gift guide this week, you have a gift for someone with a sweet tooth, the Ninja Creamy Scoop and Swirl Ice Cream Maker. Can you tell us why you made this a pick?
This thing has really kind of taken over this year. It's been really popular, you know, just kind of all around. People who like the idea of being able to make their own ice cream at home to control the ingredients that are going in it. But surprisingly also, a whole bunch of the like fitness world is really into this machine right now because you can do things like add protein powder and suddenly you have a dessert that is, you know, not only not quite as sweet as you would otherwise have, but is you know, in some ways better for you. There are a ton of different things you can do with this thing, including just make regular ice cream that is delicious. It's entirely up to you. But yeah, this thing is has, you know, it's been around for a little over a year now, and it is you won't find people who own them that have much in the way of bad things to say about them.
Okay, so this seems like an outlier of a kitchen gadget, though. Like definitely a want, not a need, right?
Sure. I mean, this is absolutely a gift. You know, this is this is certainly something that depending on the kind of person, if you are the kind of person to regularly host, you know, friends and family, then this may be a cool thing to, you know, pull out for functions like that. I wouldn't say that you absolutely must have this in your life, though.
So but if you have one, all of your kids' friends will be over every day in the summer, I guess. Is that
That's exactly right. Yeah, your freezer will be full of different concoctions that have been made over time, I'm sure.
Okay, and so just so people understand, you can make scoopable ice cream, but you can also make soft serve, right?
Yeah, so there's two different functions there. You can there's a great big friendly lever on the side that you can pull as though you are standing in front of an ice cream machine, and soft serve will come out and go into a container based on what you've made. But you can also take a ton of things and make them, you know, just like packed ice cream that you would have in the freezer.
And this will set you back a little bit. It's not a cheap machine.
It is not an inexpensive machine. Mm-hmm. These things, when they originally came out, they were $350. And in most places throughout the holidays, we've seen them as far down as $280.
Yeah. And this is something that will take up some counter space. So this is, if you have counter space luxury, then maybe you need this, right?
Not a small machine, for sure. This is either something you're bringing out on special occasions, or it's something that if you've got a large enough kitchen, that'll sit off to the side.
My sister spent a large portion of her life working at a Dairy Queen when she was young, so I could see her wanting to re-perfect her little Dairy Queen curly Q squirrel at the top with this thing.
Oh, I bet that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, moving on to the next gadget that you have. Is it the Fantic? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
The Fantic Mini Electric Screwdriver. Can you tell us about this screwdriver that seems like more than just a screwdriver?
Yeah, so this is, you know, it is an electric screwdriver in that it is, you know, kind of a very thin profile, you know, fits in just about any hand, you know, electric screwdriver that has a little tiny bit of power behind it. This is not going to replace a drill, you know, but if you have the ability to use an electric screwdriver because, you know, you want to, then this is something that is a really good option. The thing that it comes with, though, is just a ton of tool bits. That make it really handy. This has 50 magnetic bits inside, and has the way the entire thing is designed is this like really easy to use like storage cylinder for accessing all of these. I found myself tossing this in you know my home you know toolkit, and I reach for it way more often than I thought I would.
And I mean, but it does make me feel like it's a little bit of a drill. So, but it's not as powerful as a drill, right? Like I could see people using it as a tiny drill.
You could probably use this with enough force to maybe hang a picture, mm-hmm. but you're not going to be using it for anything that requires any serious amount of power.
Okay. And who would you get this electric screwdriver for?
Honestly, anybody who does any amount of handiwork at all. You know, this is something that is just, it's a really kind of nice to have thing. It has all but replaced when I use, you know, kind of screwdrivers that have finer tips to them. I found that this has replaced them. You know, my using a hand screwdriver or a ratchet screwdriver, I will reach for one of these instead, and it works really well.
I'm assuming it has like a battery you have to charge.
Yeah, it is an electric screwdriver, so you're going to charge it. I have found that I charge this thing around once a month, and it lasts for the, you know, any of the uses that I would have for that period of time. It also recharges pretty quickly. So if it conks out while you're in the middle of doing something, you can either plug it into a battery or you can have it on a charger, you know, for not more than, you know, a half an hour before you're ready to use it again.
So my Facebook algorithm has been trying to sell me one of these recently. And I think it's maybe because of your show, but or maybe it's because I looked up buying a tiny car vacuum, and now it thinks that I want random gadgets like this. Does that make sense?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, that's true. I do know folks who keep versions of these in their car, folks who do a fair bit more handiwork than I do. You know, this is it's a neat little thing, and it's, you know, for what you are getting, you know, its regular price is around $90, and I've seen it in a bunch of places for closer to $70 for the holidays, which is nice for what you're getting out of this.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about holiday gifts, and Russell Hawley is here with his holiday gift guide. He's the Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Another thing I wanted to talk about is the Roku streaming stick, which is cheaper than ever and making streaming easier. What kind of new features has, or like, what? Why get a Roku stick for someone?
I find this is a really interesting question, because I find that when folks ask me what I use in my own house to do a lot of streaming stuff with, there are some surprised reactions when I say that Roku is the one that I typically go to and recommend over something like an Apple TV or you know, some of the more expensive sets. And really, it just comes down to the Roku remote is really simple to use. Anybody that comes into your house knows exactly how it works. There are no secret buttons or touchpads or anything like that. You know, the software itself is really self-explanatory. It's very easy to navigate for you know, just about any age. But my very personal favorite feature from any Roku device is, if you, instead of using the Roku stick, you have the Roku app on your phone, any Bluetooth headphone you have connected to your phone can play the audio from your television. So if you have a TV in your room, in your bedroom, and your partner is asleep, you can watch TV completely silently, you know, just having the audio through your headphones. If you are working in a room that has quite a bit of other noise going on, you know, you can route all of that audio to your headphones. The only thing that is necessary is that the headphones that are be connected to your phone with the Roku app on your phone, and it's a simple button press, and all the audio just immediately transfers to your headphones. And I use this feature quite a bit.
Oh wow, okay. And you mentioned that the remote is easy to use. I'm an Apple TV person, and I can remember trying to teach a few members of my family how to use the Apple TV remote, and that was not easy.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's you know, a handful of very simple buttons with some shortcut keys on there. It doesn't get easier than that. The remote's also super easy to replace if it gets lost or chewed up by a dog. Mm. The same of which cannot be said about the Apple TV remote, which ends up being quite expensive to replace. Again, guess how I know.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, there's quite a bit that goes into this thing being just really simple, but also incredibly inexpensive. So if you have a TV that maybe doesn't already have some of these smart streaming things on them, or you're not happy with the ones that are built into your television, it's really easy to take one of these, the streaming sticks, just plug into the back, and then you never see it again. And, you know, if you want something that has, you know, 4K streaming or something that gives you kind of the best possible picture, there are slightly more expensive versions of the Roku stick to go for. But for most folks, the standard Roku streaming stick that does 4K and HDR is usually around $30 and will do everything that I need it to do on a regular basis.
And does a Roku stick work with any TV, basically, for the most part?
Anything that's got an HDMI port in the back, which at this point is very nearly every television.
Okay. So
sometimes I'll even bring these with me if I'm traveling, because I can put them in a hotel room television, and then I've got all of my apps and stuff already set up. Not every television in every hotel makes that easy. But in a lot of places it, you know, I can just plug it in and I've got everything already there.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay. So this is a good gift for someone who maybe is either frustrated with what they have, or maybe you want to expose them to something more than their cable or their over-the-air TV.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you've got someone who is very frustrated by their television, this is usually a good first step for me. If you've got someone who, you know, is, you know, just not excited by swiping around on their phone in order to control something on their television, this is usually, you know, something that I go to recommend as well.
And finally, you wanted to just mention virtual gift cards or digital gift cards as a great alternative, as a gift, as an alternative to a physical gift card. Tell me why you wanted to talk about that.
So there are lots of different retailers that offer digital gift cards this time of year, where if, you know, someone has shown up quite unexpectedly and you don't want them to, you know, feel left out, then you can make that order really quickly. It shows up in your email, and then you can either print it out or, you know, forward the email to them in order to make sure that they have that gift. But the other reason is that this time of year, especially if you crawl around on Amazon every once in a while, there are almost always gift cards that are a few bucks less than what you're actually getting. Mm-hmm. You know, through Black Friday, there were a lot of these. We ended up talking about one or two of them where like AMC Theaters had a $50 gift card that only cost $40. Mm-hmm. You know, and so in a lot of cases, that's almost one free ticket. You know, included in whatever you spent. So my recommendation there, especially if, you know, you're looking to get something for someone who is either not going to be physically with you this year or is going to be quite surprised, or even if you just want to save a couple of bucks, is to take a look through the gift cards at Amazon. You know, take a look and see if any of your favorite local bookstores do digital gift cards, because most of them do. And that way you're able to, you know, not have to worry so much about having a physical gift in places where it would be difficult to do so.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I could see physical gift cards getting lost, and then the money's just like, poof, it's gone because you've lost the gift card. But if it's a digital gift card, it's always in your email somewhere.
That's exactly right. It's always in your email. And you know, you can be quite flexible about the kind of gift card that you're getting and how that ends up being applied, especially if you're getting a gift card for someone who has a Nintendo Switch, for example. You know, the gift card for a Nintendo Switch, the Nintendo gift card works for everything. So it's not just games. You can also buy controllers and accessories and things like that for the console with just that one gift card. So that can be a pretty versatile answer as well.
Is there any worry that people need to be worried about internet scams when purchasing a digital gift card, or any worries like that?
It's really important that you make sure that you're getting, you know, from a reputable retailer. If you're buying from someone local that does digital gift cards, keep an eye on the site for the, you know, kind of brand mark for whatever shopping system they work with, be it, you know, Clear or Stripe or something like that. You will see, you know, those indications there. And then if you make a purchase like that, immediately check your email to make sure that the receipt and the copy of the card and something like that is actually in your email so that you have a verification of it. I belong to the generation of folks that screenshots that checkout page to make sure that I have, you know, confirmation that there's an order number there. You can always go down that route. But the other thing that you can keep in mind is that if you haven't seen that email show up and you're a little worried, for a lot of things like gift cards, most credit cards will do chargebacks on those pretty easy.
Well, for our listeners out there, this is the third week that Russell Holley has given us gift suggestions. So if you missed anything, you need to listen back to the last 2 weeks of Tech Tuesday. There were a lot of good ones in there. A really cool robot building kit, a good affordable drone, smart TV backlights, which are is the gift I didn't know I ever wanted, and then a good suggestion for a Bluetooth speaker, so much more. So be sure to listen back to the last 2 weeks of Tech Tuesday at our website or as a podcast. And I just want to say thank you to Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for your gift guide, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.